Okay, I'm here with Andrew Gazdecki of Acquire.com. Thank you so much for coming on the pod today.
Yeah, Nicole, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So Andrew, obviously this is a Meteor Masterminds podcast. So we're going to be diving into the power of social media and how to utilize it to your advantage. You have built a very impressive platform. You have over 300,000 followers across various different channels. And you have built a business that helps companies get acquired. And so I want to kick it over to you so that you can give us your background and what you do right now.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate that introduction as well. Background on me, been an entrepreneur pretty much my whole life. I've been building businesses, selling stuff since I was a kid. Previously started a SaaS company, bootstrapped that to about $10 million in recurring revenue. Exited that business when I was 29. Then started a crypto protocol company after that. Don't ask me why. I call that one landing the plane in the Hudson River. It was acquired by a strategic buyer, BNK to the future. And just going through all those acquisitions, you know, I felt so just, it was a confusing process. It, you know, distracted me from, you know, building my business. And that led me to Acquire.com to really just help educate founders on acquisitions, educate the market on acquisitions, specifically for businesses that may not, you know, have the resources to hire an investment bank or a business broker. So we focus on generally startups that are looking to sell for $20 million or less. That's kind of our sweet spot, but we can transact higher. And yeah, our mission at Acquire.com is to make acquisitions easier for startups across the globe.
Awesome. And the reason I am so excited to have you on this pod is because I think you have a very interesting view on the VC ecosystem, raising funds from VCs, and sort of the trade-offs with that versus bootstrapping. And so my first question to you is, when you're a founder, how do you think about whether to raise VC funding versus bootstrapping? And for those that you think should bootstrap, how do you go about bootstrapping when maybe you don't have the funds yourself to get a startup off the ground?
Yeah, great question. Probably one of my favorite topics. So when I think about, let's start with whether or not you should raise venture capital or when you should bootstrap. I think what a lot of entrepreneurs forget is that, you know, self-funding a business or bootstrapping a business is a really viable and smart option. I think there's this Silicon Valley narrative that we all have been attached to, which is, you know, you get in a Y Combinator, you raise some money, you raise some more money. But ironically, when you do that, the chances of your startup being a financial success goes down immensely because your exit optionality decreases. And what I mean by that is, you know, the bar when you raise venture capital is to build a business ideally worth hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And that's not easy to do. And that applies for, you know, Acquire.com. And so just understanding, you know, what you're getting yourself into, I think is key. And the second thing I would point out is, you know, really understand, like, what are you trying to get out of your startup? I think a lot of founders, you know, believe that you have to build a startup to change the world or to disrupt a huge market. And if that's your goal, raise venture capital because you're going to need it. But for most founders, if they're just really honest with themselves, and I talk to a lot of founders on a daily basis, you know, most just want financial security. Most just want to build something that, you know, scratches, you know, some sort of pain or itch or problem that they've personally experienced. And if you bootstrap that company and you're able to get to, you know, even 100,000 or a couple hundred thousand or a couple million in revenue, you can sell that business whenever you want for whatever you want. And that can lead to a life-changing outcome. I know it sounds wild, but selling a business for just $5 million, well, we'll change your life. You won't be on the front page of Forbes or anything like that. But I just think it's a more viable and just realistic and more practical path of entrepreneurship especially for first-time entrepreneurs. And then in terms of, you know, how do you bootstrap a business today without any sort of funds? For me, you know, one metric that I always looked at was customer payback period. So what that means is when you bootstrap a business, you want to be able to reinvest customer revenue quickly into the business as quickly as possible. So as an example, if you raise venture capital, you can afford to acquire a customer where they become profitable at month 13, 14 or something like that. But when you bootstrap a business, you want to get that number down to ideally below 30 days. So as a personal example, at Business Apps, our customer payback period was around 27, 28, 29 days, and we kept it that way. So you need to get clever with, number one, your unit economics. So how quickly are you able to get to profitability with each customer? And then another thing we did at Business Apps, the company I bootstrapped, was we had a go-to-market strategy that leveraged other individuals. And what I mean by that is we were heavy on partnerships, heavy on white label resellers. And these people essentially acted like our outsourced sales team. So you have to think about really clever go-to-market strategies that are very low cost for you to acquire customers, because you can't afford to outspend another company on Google AdWords or Facebook or whatever it may be. So it needs to be a really organic growth strategy. And then that growth strategy needs to have a customer payback period that's ideally as low as possible.
So what's your recommendation for founders who need to build their product and they can't get customers yet, right? Because they need to build the product. And so how long do you recommend to do the building process before going out to get your customers where you can then start evaluating and optimizing that payback period, right? Because we invest in obviously pre-seed, seed businesses, and some of them are pre-revenue. Some of them are still in the process of building product, right? And so building that product can take months, right? And so how do you balance that with a bootstrap business?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, because I believe the bar for like a minimum viable product MVP has gone up today just with all the competition within markets. And so you can't get that first impression back. Like when I launched Business Apps back in 2010, the first version was so terrible and only I could use it. And it was just a white page where I'd upload images. It was bad. But we eventually improved it with customer revenue. So I guess one solution to kind of, you know, maybe go around your question, providing just maybe an alternative sort of perspective is, you know, if you find a problem, and this is a great way to not only build a really great product, but to start generating customer revenue immediately, is try delivering the service or the solution to whatever problem you're trying to solve manually. That could be just through an agency or something like that. That can be just through you manually building out the feature sets of whatever problem that you're solving. There's a number of different, you know, use cases like that. But then what you're able to do is you're immediately able to start learning more about the nuances of the problem. And then you start to automate the manual delivery of the solution to the problem. And so to directly answer your question, how long should you spend working on the product? I think it really depends on, you know, the market, how big the problem is. But generally, I think you can get away with a lot less in terms of delivering the solution manually and just get started right away and just have that focus on customers from day one, rather than thinking, I got to get this perfect product and that's when I'll be successful, because it typically never works like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So be scrappy in the beginning, be resourceful, and then start automating over time as you have revenue coming in.
That makes sense. If you're bootstrapping, you just have to be as scrappy as possible, yeah, because you don't have another option.
Totally. Totally. And so another way, I guess, for bootstrapped companies to have distribution is through media, right? And so you've tweeted before that if your startup is a leader for content and media in your space, you'll probably become the overall market leader too, right? So you obviously believe in the power of media for startups. So I'm curious, how do you think about the media strategy for a company that isn't a media first business?
Yeah, so that tweet kind of got some heat around it in terms of misunderstanding. So let me clarify. So there's definitely a difference between a media company and having a very heavy content-led strategy. That's really what I mean, is create a lot of content, you know, have a blog, create, you know, great resources for your customers, really fill top of funnel, educate your market. A media company, on the other hand, is, you know, newsletter, pot, like, you know, I want to distinguish that. But yeah, so, I mean, you know, using Acquire.com as an example, when I started the business, there was very limited information on acquisitions. And if you think about startups in general, there's books on marketing, there's books on sales, there's books on social media strategy, there's 1,000 books on fundraising, but there's not a lot of information on acquisitions or exits. And so to me, that presented a huge opportunity for us to educate the market and become a leader in resources or just information about what is due diligence or what is a good letter of intent or what are red flags for buyers or what is even simple terms like a data room, you know, also providing data to the market, like what is my startup worth? And so if you have a customer that's looking for a solution to whatever problem they have, in this example we're using, I'm looking to sell my business, the more that you can educate them and think of marketing kind of like, this is probably a bad analogy, but I like to think of marketing like you're standing next to like a freeway every single day, because people forget about you so often. And so I always say that your main competitor isn't the two or three companies that kind of do what you do. It's customer attention. And so the more that you're able to put out content, write meaningful blog posts that really resonate with people, going on podcasts like this, telling your brand story, all that really adds up and creates a lot of affinity with customers because you're giving away value for free. And so when they need your services, ideally you'll be the first person they think about.
Yeah, I think about this a lot when it comes to media, this darling effect, whereas if you give a lot, hopefully they'll come back to you when they are ready to get acquired or they're ready for something, right? Because they appreciate so much that you gave them the resources for free. So we think a lot about that at Harlem Capital, and I do it myself as well. I'm curious though, what are some sort of tactical tricks that you have for founders who want to start building this brand, want to have a content creation strategy? How do you get over that hill? Because it is a skill, right? It's not just something that you can do. You have to work at it and build up. So what are some tactical tricks that I guess maybe helped you get started or have helped some founders that you've spoken to get started?
Yeah, I would say the first thing is, you know, you really need to have like a brand voice. So I've written down my brand voice like 4 years ago and it's on a whiteboard, but it's been on there for so long, I can't even erase it. But I just wrote down like humorous, motivational, startups, top of mind, you know, it's just a brand voice that is me essentially. And when it comes to creating content, I always say the best way to have a content strategy is you need to figure out a way to make it fun. So when I tweet, you'll notice most of my tweets, Twitter removed it, but or X, whatever we call it. But it's usually just from my iPhone. I mean, I'm drinking coffee in the morning and I don't know, I'm just writing something for fun. So not overthinking it, being consistent is huge. And then also, again, standing for something and having a unique opinion or voice on a certain situation. And some clever things that we did at Acquire that were kind of fun was beef marketing. I don't recommend it for everybody, but we did this beef marketing campaign with TechCrunch because this was in 2021 and 2022, and the funding markets were going crazy. And most of the customers and startups that we support are self-funded or bootstrapped or haven't raised venture capital. And then my previous business was bootstrapped. And so we leveraged them like, hey, we're, you know, we even launched a mini publication that we've since deprecated called bootstrappers.com, which basically just outlined what I like to read, which is just real motivational stories about people building companies. So standing for something, you know, really, you know, having some sort of brand message that's unique. One way not to build a social media presence is by copying other people or posting random memes or something like that. Like, you'll get followers and stuff like that. You'll get likes and clicks, and or, I don't know about clicks, but you'll get likes. But you want to be known as you know, an expert in one area, and that can be as niche as acquisitions, or even more niche SaaS acquisitions, or more niche such as profitable SaaS acquisitions. Like, you can keep going narrower, narrower, narrower. But the key is really to be known for, you know, consistent types of content, and then making it fun so you stick with it.
Totally, totally. I think staying niche in the beginning is key, and then expanding from there. I know Harry Stebbings says this a lot, because obviously when he created 20VC, it was very targeted. And now he's expanded it to 20 sales and, you know, a whole bunch of other things. But I think being niche at the beginning, when you're building your audience, and someone, you know, for me, it's like, if someone says, how do I break it to VC? Someone's like, go check out Nicole's Twitter, right? For you, it's like, if you want to get your startup acquired, go check out Andrew's Twitter, right? And so I think, or X, I should say. But I think that's important. And I guess a question that we get a lot from our founders is how to balance this content creation with building your business, right? Because obviously it takes a decent amount of time to create quality content. Less so if you're tweeting once a day, but if you're talking about blog posts, if you're talking about podcast appearances, that time starts to add up, of which as a founder, you don't necessarily have that much of, right? And so what are some key KPIs or key metrics that you look for to gauge the ROI on this content creation, and whether you should be focusing your time there or focusing more, let's say, on your go-to-market or building your product?
Yeah, I think the simplest way to, you know, track just general ROI on your content is it producing, you know, any sort of meaningful leads, traffic, users, usage of your product, whatever it may be. Like, we're able to track how many users we get from each social platform, and then also the content that we create. And then as a founder too, yeah, don't spend all your time on Twitter. Spend your time, you know, building your business. There's the key of like trying to figure out a way to make it fun. So it's super easy and simple. You don't need to write these 50 post threads and stuff like that. I think there's, you know, a lot of people appreciate just being able to take a really complex message and simplify it. So if you're able to, you know, find kind of a tone of voice where, you know, it doesn't take that much time, I think that's great. And then in terms of, you know, writing longer form, you know, content, if you're able to, hire a copywriter. That was the first marketing hire I made at acquire.com, because I felt content was one of the best, you know, ROI channels for any sort of business. And it allows you to really articulate your story in a much better way. Because as a founder, you're right, you can't spend like a whole day writing a blog post or anything like that. So kind of a cop-out answer, but I would say, in the beginning, you might have to do everything. I've been there. But if you have the resources, you can hire freelance copywriters, people on, you know, Upwork that are fantastic writers for single posts. So I would leverage, you know, platforms that allow you to maybe hire part-time people if you're not able to hire a full-time writer.
Maybe even ChatGPT now, some AI platform.
Yeah. But no, that's very true.
I don't know. How much time do you spend on your content creation? Out of curiosity.
Candidly, it depends on the day or how I'm feeling, but not really too much. I think a lot less than people would expect. I think the best tweets are the ones where it just kind of pops in your head. It's not pre-planned or anything like that. And that, I also like creating content that way. It's just more fun. Again, making it fun, you're consistent. When you're consistent, it works. And so I think the fun aspect is something that's always top of mind for me. So if I feel like I have to like write, I don't got anything to say today.
I get that.
If I had to put a time on it, I'd say maybe half an hour, hour most. Just depends.
Per day.
Yeah, but I should put a caveat. That also includes, customer questions, stuff like that. A big part of social for me can sometimes be answering questions or helping people.
And so I'm curious, when you got started, how did you think about the formats or the channels that you were going to focus on, right? Because I think there's so many ways to build a brand on social media or other formats, whether you decide to do a newsletter, whether you decide to start a podcast, whether you decide LinkedIn is going to be your platform or Twitter is going to be your platform or Instagram, whatever it is, right? There's so many different channels where you can get consumer eyeballs, right? And so I'm curious, as a founder, what should they be thinking about in terms of different platforms to launch or focus on? Does it depend on the industry, the product that you're building, or your end user? Could you talk me through how you thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want to go where your customers are. Otherwise, you're just kind of sharing, valuable content into the abyss. For me, I mean, it was very obvious that our core customer startups are heavy users of X, Twitter, whatever. Also LinkedIn, Instagram, pretty much all social platforms. But for, let's say you sell to like insurance agents or something, that's super niche, or dog walker, I don't know.
Yeah.
it might be Reddit. It might be a Facebook community or something like that. There's so many different avenues, but I would say that's goal number one, is figure out where your customers hang out and put your content there.
And so I want to also shift gears a bit and talk about traditional media coverage of startups, because I know that the traditional media outlets for startups and VC cover funding rounds as a metric of success, right? And you've long pushed back against that sort of on your Twitter, on X. And so I'm curious, what do you think about the startup coverage today? And what are sort of the implications of that coverage that you see?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty bad. I don't read any of it. Being candid, when I was growing up, I used to read TechCrunch every morning, every single morning. It was the first publication I would read when I woke up. And the reason for that was they would cover stories where these startups had not been funded. Some of the stories would be, I remember some great ones, such as just two people made an app and it's kind of working and we thought it was interesting. So we wrote an article. It was inspiring. It was like, these two people made something, like maybe I could build something too and I can learn from this. But now when I read a lot of the, tech articles, it is really weighted towards, financing rounds or, really, really large acquisitions or, public company information. To take it even a step further, I mean, we've gotten to the point where you can sell a company for $1 billion and then the tech media is like, well, their last round was like $1.4 billion. This really happened to Loom, which I read and I was like, this is a monumental achievement. And this is how you're going to position this as a failure. So I think the bigger message I'd like to get across though is, when I was reading TechCrunch, I was 19, 20, just, kid with a dream to build a startup. And so, that motivated me in terms of, okay, like there's people without a lot of resources making stuff happen. And now I think what the typical sort of, storyline of how to build a startup is skewed towards this, you got to raise venture funding, you got to get into these magazines, you got to, get into this accelerator, you got to do all these different things. And I think that can be a very unrealistic view of what entrepreneurship really is. And it steers away from building, what might be a great you know, 10, 20, $30 million business a year, but you end up raising venture capital. So you try to go bigger and then the business doesn't work out. And so I think it can just skew sort of just, again, the perception of entrepreneurship and really defining what success as an entrepreneur is. Because I always like to say, you don't need to have a $1 billion outcome to be successful as an entrepreneur. And, you know, I think there's just been a huge shift towards, you know, people are drawn to extremes, so I get it. But 10 years ago, it wasn't like that. It was more, I felt it was more inspiring and more motivating, especially for people just starting out.
Totally. And I think the reality of the situation is that most startups are not VC backable in terms of their growth path, right? And I feel like there, you're right, there is a skew that if you're not VC backable, you're not quote unquote a good business, which is just fundamentally not the case. It's just a math game, right? It just has, you have to have the right business model. You have to have the right sort of, you know, whatever it is, industry size. And so, you know, I feel like I'm always constantly saying to people, like, you can build a great business and not raise VC funding, right? And still have an amazing outcome, like still have life-changing generational wealth outcome. So appreciate that. And I guess I'm curious, what is your recommendation for bootstrap founders for getting coverage sort of in media, right? Or do you recommend only doing on your own channels, right? I'm curious what your take is there.
Yeah, so Business Apps, the company I've been telling you about that I started in college, we were featured in TechCrunch like 10 times. We were in every single publication you can think of, from New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Read Write Web, VentureBeat. I was even a guest author for TechCrunch, VentureBeat, Inc. magazine. But what I think is happened is, you know, these publications, there's so many different outlets to get your startup in. Gather attention. I'm losing my words here. And that's why I chose, you know, when I launched Acquire.com, to really own my own distribution channels in terms of communication. So instead of relying, and that, I think that's a big shift that I've personally seen or noticed in terms of how do you get attention for your startup? You're less reliant on these, you know, big, you know, media platforms, and you can actually have a unique brand story that's arguably more, you know, powerful and has the ability to reach more people. And then it's also authentic. It's you telling the story. It's not kind of, you know, written in the form of, you know, how a reporter might view that. But if you're a bootstrap company, I mean, I think you want to lean into your strengths, like lean into how much you've been able to accomplish with limited resources, or how you're, you know, there's, oh, everybody loves, you know, a David versus Goliath story. So that's, you know, one angle to take. But it's definitely tough. I mean, I haven't seen too much coverage of self-funded bootstrap companies compared to, you know, a decade ago. So I wouldn't bank on it. I would focus more on creating your own, you know, distribution channels instead of relying on, you know, the larger publications.
And is there a bootstrap company that you can think of that did a successful job at building this brand with their own channels? Or even if they did get media publications, is there a particular company where you're like, that is an amazing case study on a founder who just nailed it?
I mean, there's the big ones like MailChimp definitely comes to mind. Yeah, I think, you know, if you really, really tap into something, I mean, believe it or not, Microsoft, they only raised $1 million. You know, so, and the reason they raised $1 million is Bill Gates is quoted as saying he felt he had to be taken seriously. Dell Computers also, I believe, raised no money all the way up until their IPO. Yeah, I think it just depends.
The one that keeps popping into my head is MailChimp. Because I feel like that one just happened, and obviously everybody was like, oh my gosh, you know, bootstrapped the entire way. So that's great.
One thing I would add is there's a number of companies that were bootstrapped for a long time before they raised capital. Like you have GitHub, GitLab, I believe. So there are a number of companies that you can look up where, you know, they, Zapier, I think, has only raised, you know, a very, very small amount of money compared to how much revenue they're generating. So if you're looking for examples, just go into ChatGPT and just type in bootstrap startups that, you know, have grown to millions in revenue, and you'll get a good list, and you can kind of reverse engineer just what they did. And that can work for a lot of different markets.
I like that. So curious, now that we brought up sort of the bootstrapping to then VC funding way later in the journey, how do you think about when to get acquired, right? Like, when do you know, okay, it's time for me to sell this business versus, oh, let me raise some growth capital so I can accelerate this to a bigger exit? Are there any like tangible tricks that you have for founders?
I think the simplest answer is when you get an offer you just can't turn down, you know? But it's a very personal question. Like, I sold business apps because I was exhausted. I had been running the business for 8-9 years. Altcoin, I sold because we ran into some regulatory compliance issues. This was when all Ethereum-based tokens were deemed as security. So if we were to launch a company, it was going to be deemed as a unregulated securities exchange, which is a big no-no. So we sold the company to another company that had the regulatory approvals. So it just depends. Like, you could be doing great and you just want to cash in your chips and go lay on a beach. Awesome. You could be getting exhausted and you want to start working on another startup. That's probably the bucket I was in. It could be just you want to, you know, retire, or the business isn't going as well as you'd like it to. And, you know, there's a myriad of reasons. And I don't think the only one that really, really just makes sense is when you just get an offer that's just too good to turn down. But aside from that, I think it's, you know, are you losing passion in the business? Are you in a position where you're kind of a fork in the road where, like you said, you can raise, you know, some additional growth capital or sell the business? That's a great off ramp if you're looking to get acquired. So it really just depends, like, how much gas do you have in the tank? What are your personal goals? Going back to my, one of my first question or answers to your question was, you know, write down like maybe a number or what do you really want out of this startup? And I think that'll help guide a lot of your decision-making process. Cause if you can hit that number, then you should sell the business. And then if you're not at that number, keep going. And then if things go terribly wrong, then maybe, you know, that's another time to think about selling the business, or if you're exhausted. So there's a myriad of reasons, and we see a lot of them. But it's always a personal question in terms of, you know, when is the right time, aside from, you know, getting that dream offer.
Totally. So you keep saying about this dream offer that maybe you would take regardless of the situation of the business. I'm curious, are you actively always looking for potential buyers, or should you as a founder? I know obviously if you raise VC capital, the incentives are slightly misaligned, but I'm curious for bootstrap founders. And I read one of your articles, which you noted some mistakes that you made when you sold your first startup. And one of them was not having a relationship with potential buyers all the time. So I'm curious, are these dream offers just given to you without sort of a process and without actively looking? So if I'm a founder, should I always be sort of prospecting?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you're looking to sell to, so there's financial buyers, and those are private equity firms. Basically, we'll just leave it at private equity firms. And that basically means they're a company that buys other software companies. And so they're always going to be in the market looking to buy a company like yours. And then there's strategic buyers. So strategic buyers, to have a successful acquisition with a strategic buyer, typically it takes a longer time because a relationship needs to be built, fostered. The best way to do that is typically through partnerships, you know, really get to know each other culturally and how your products align and what sort of synergies there are. So from day one, that's something I highly recommend, and something, you know, I've tried to always do, specifically with Altcoin. From the day we launched, I let potential acquirers know that we were building this and that it could be interesting. And so when we were in a situation where it made a lot of sense to sell the business, we were able to sell it pretty quickly. So the sooner you can start those conversations, even if they're just coffee chats, just, hey, I just want to get on your radar, you know, if you're able to position your business as just a puzzle piece that could fit into a larger entity and just get on the radar sooner rather than later, because you don't want to get to a point where you're at the end of the road, you have to sell the business, but you have a list of like 20 companies you'd love to sell for and you'd be a perfect fit for, but you haven't built a relationship. They don't know who you are. They don't know what you do. And so you can't accelerate that sale process. So absolutely start creating relationships as soon as possible.
Awesome. I love that advice. And so final question here, because I think we hit on a lot of amazing things. Where can people find you? And I guess, like, if I'm a founder who wants to get acquired, what's the criteria to list on acquire.com?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on social, just at A. Gazdecki, if you can spell it correctly, LinkedIn, Andrew Gazdecki. And then if you have any acquisition questions, feel free to email me, andrew@acquire.com. Happy to help. And then in terms of, you know, listing requirements on acquire.com, the best companies that we typically list are SaaS companies. So if you have a SaaS company that's profitable and you're looking for an exit, definitely go to acquire.com and check us out.
Awesome, Andrew. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I can't wait for the public to hear this. I think there's so many good tidbits in here. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.